Doctor's Case by Stephen King, read by Tim Curry. I believe there was only one occasion upon which I actually solved a crime before my slightly fabulous friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. I say believe because my memory began to grow hazy about the edges as I entered my ninth decade. Now, as I approach my centennial, the whole has become downright misty. There may have been another occasion, but if so, I do not remember it. I doubt that I shall ever forget this particular case, no matter how murky my thoughts and memories may become, and I thought I might as well set it down before God caps my pen forever. It cannot humiliate Holmes now, God knows. He is 40 years in his grave. That, I think, is long enough to leave the tale untold. Even Lestrade, who used Holmes upon occasion, but never had any great liking for him, never broke his silence in the matter of Lord Hull. He hardly could have done so, considering the circumstances. Even if the circumstances had been different, I somehow doubt he would have. He and Holmes baited each other, and I believe that Holmes may have harboured actual hate in his heart for the policeman, although he never would have admitted to such a low emotion. But Lestrade had a queer respect for my friend. It was a wet, dreary afternoon, and the clock had just rung 1:30. Holmes sat by the window, holding his violin, but not playing it, looking silently out into the rain. There were times, especially once his cocaine days were behind him, when Holmes would grow moody to the point of surliness, when the skies remained stubbornly grey for a week or more, and he had been doubly disappointed on this day, for the glass had been rising since late the night before, and he had confidently predicted clearing skies by 10 this morning at the latest. Instead, the mist, which had been hanging in the air when I arose, had thickened into a steady rain, and if there was anything which rendered Holmes moodier than long periods of rain, it was being wrong. Suddenly he straightened up, tweaking a violin string with a fingernail, and smiled sardonically. "Watson, here's a sight, the wettest bloodhound you ever saw." It was Lestrade, of course, seated in the back of an open wagon, with water running into his close-set, fiercely inquisitive eyes. The wagon had no more than stopped before he was out, flinging the driver a coin and striding toward 221B Baker Street. He moved so quickly that I thought he should run into our door like a battering ram. I heard Mrs. Hudson remonstrating with him about his decidedly damp condition and the effect it might have on the rugs both downstairs and up, and then Holmes, who could make Lestrade look like a tortoise when the urge struck him, leaped across to the door and called down, "Let him up, Mrs. H. I'll put a newspaper under his boots if he stays long, but somehow I think, yes, I really do think that..." Then Lestrade was bounding up the stairs, leaving Mrs. Hudson to expostulate below. His colour was high, his eyes burned, and his teeth, decidedly yellowed by tobacco, were bared in a wolfish grin. "Inspector Lestrade!" Holmes cried jovially. "What brings you out on such a—" No further did he get. Still panting from his climb, Lestrade said, "I've heard gypsies say the devil grants wishes. Now I believe it. Come at once if you'd have a try, Holmes. The corpse is still fresh, and the suspects all in a row." "You frighten me with your ardour, Lestrade," Holmes cried, but with a sardonic little waggle of his eyebrows. "Don't play the shrinking violet with me, man. I've come at the run to offer you the very thing for which you in your pride have wished 100 times or more in my own hearing. The perfect locked room mystery." Holmes had started into the corner, perhaps to get the awful gold-tipped cane which he was for some reason affecting that season. Now he whirled upon our damp visitor, his eyes wide. "Lestrade, Are you serious? Would I have risked wet lung croup riding here in an open wagon if I were not? Lestrade countered. Then, for the only time in my hearing, despite the countless times the phrase has been attributed to him, Holmes turned to me and cried, "Quick, Watson! The game's afoot!" On our way, Lestrade commented sourly that Holmes also had the luck of the devil. Although Lestrade had commanded the wagon driver to wait, we had no more than emerged from our lodgings when that exquisite rarity clip-clopped down the street, an empty hackney in what had become a driving rain. We climbed in and were off in a trice. As always, Holmes sat on the left-hand side, his eyes darting restlessly about, cataloguing everything, although there was precious little to see on that day, or so it seemed, at least, to the likes of me. I've no doubt every empty street corner and rain-washed shop window spoke volumes to Holmes. Lestrade directed the driver to an address in Savile Row, and then asked Holmes if he knew Lord Hull. "I know of him," Holmes said, "but have never had the good fortune of meeting him. Now, I suppose, I never shall. Shipping, wasn't it?"
"Shipping," Lestrade agreed. "But the good fortune was yours. Lord Hull was, by all accounts, including those of his nearest and dearest, a thoroughly nasty fellow, and as dotty as a puzzle picture in a child's novelty book. He's finished practising both nastiness and dottiness for good, however. Around 11 o'clock this morning, just..." He pulled out his turnip of a pocket watch and looked at it. 2 hours and 40 minutes ago, someone put a knife in his back as he sat in his study with his will on the blotter before him.
"So," Holmes said thoughtfully, lighting his pipe, "you believe the study of this unpleasant Lord Hull is the perfect locked room of my dreams, do you?" His eyes gleamed sceptically through a rising rafter of blue smoke.
"I believe," Lestrade said quietly, "that it is."
"Watson and I have dug such holes before and never struck water," Holmes remarked, and he glanced at me before returning to his ceaseless catalogue of the streets through which we passed. "Do you recall the speckled band, Watson?" I hardly needed to answer him. There had been a locked room in that business, true enough, but there had also been a ventilator, a poisonous snake, and a killer fiendish enough to introduce the latter into the former. It had been the work of a cruelly brilliant mind, but Holmes had seen to the bottom of the matter in almost no time at all.
"What are the facts, Inspector?" Holmes asked.
Lestrade began to lay them before us in the clipped tones of a trained policeman. Lord Albert Hull had been a tyrant in business and a despot at home. His wife had gone in fear of him and had apparently been justified in doing so. The fact that she had borne him 3 sons seemed in no way to have moderated his savage approach toward their domestic affairs in general and toward her in particular. Lady Hull had been reluctant to speak of these matters, but her sons had no such reservations. Their papa, they said, had missed no opportunity to dig at her, to criticise her, or to jest at her expense. All of this when they were in company. When they were alone, he virtually ignored her, except, Lestrade added, when he felt moved to beat her, which was by no means an uncommon occurrence. William, the eldest, told me she always gave out the same story when she came to the breakfast table with a swollen eye or a mark on her cheek, that she had forgotten to put on her spectacles and had run into a door. "She ran into doors once and twice a week," William said. "I didn't know we had that many doors in the house."
"Hmm," Holmes said. "A cheery fellow. The sons never put a stop to it?"
"She wouldn't allow it," Lestrade said.
"Insanity," I returned. "A man who would beat his wife is an abomination. A woman who would allow it, an abomination and a perplexity."
"There was a method in her madness, though," Lestrade said. "Method
and what you might call an informed patience. She was, after all, 20 years younger than her lord and master. Also, Hull was a heavy drinker and a champion diner. At age 70, 5 years ago, he developed gout and angina. "Wait for the storm to end and then enjoy the sunshine," Holmes remarked. "Yes," Lestrade said, "but it's an idea which has led many a man and woman through the devil's door, I'll be bound. Hull made sure his family knew both his worth and the provisions of his will. They were little better than slaves." "With the will as their document of indenture," Holmes murmured. "Exactly so, old boy. At the time of his death, Hull's worth was £300,000. He never asked them to take his word for this. He had his chief accountant to the house, quarterly, to detail the balance sheets of Hull's shipping, although he kept the purse strings firmly in his own hands and tightly closed. Devilish!" I exclaimed, thinking of the cruel boys one sometimes sees in Eastcheap or Piccadilly, boys who will hold out a sweet to a starving dog to see it dance, and then gobble it themselves while the hungry animal watches. I was shortly to find this comparison even more apt than I would have thought possible. On his death, Lady Rebecca was to receive £150,000. William, the eldest, was to receive £50,000. Jory, the middler, 40, and Stephen, the youngest, 30. "And the other 30,000? I asked. "Small bequests, Watson. To a cousin in Wales, an aunt in Brittany, not a cent for Lady Hull's relatives, though. 5,000 in assorted bequests to the servants. Oh, and you'll like this, Holmes. £10,000 to Mrs. Hemphill's Home for Abandoned Pussies." "You're joking!" I cried, although if Lestrade expected a similar reaction from Holmes, he was disappointed. Holmes merely relighted his pipe and nodded as if he had expected this or something like it. "With babies dying of starvation in the East End and 12-year-old children working 50 hours a week in the mills, this fellow left £10,000 to a boarding hotel for cats." "Exactly so," Lestrade said pleasantly. "Furthermore, he should have left 27 times that amount to Mrs. Hemphill's Abandoned Pussies, if not for whatever happened this morning, and whoever did the business." I could only gape at this and try to multiply in my head. While I was coming to the conclusion that Lord Hull had intended to disinherit both wife and children in favour of a rest home for felines, Holmes was looking sourly at Lestrade and saying something which sounded to me like a total non sequitur. "I am going to sneeze, am I not?" Lestrade smiled. It was a smile of transcendent sweetness. "Yes, my dear Holmes, often and profoundly, I fear." Holmes removed his pipe, which he had just gotten drawing to his satisfaction. I could tell by the way he settled back slightly in his seat, looked at it for a moment, and then held it out into the rain. More dumbfounded than ever, I watched him knock out the damp and smouldering tobacco. "How many?" Holmes asked. 10. Lestrade said with a fiendish grin. "I suspected it was more than this famous locked room of yours that brought you out in the back of an open wagon on such a wet day," Holmes said sourly. "Suspect as you like," Lestrade said gaily. "I'm afraid I must go on to the scene of the crime. Duty calls, you know. But if you'd like, I could let you and the good doctor out here." "You are the only man I ever met," Holmes said, "whose wit seems to be sharpened by foul weather. Does that perhaps say something about your character, I wonder? But never mind, that is perhaps a subject for another day. Tell me this, Lestrade. When did Lord Hull become sure that he was going to die?" "Die?" I said. "My dear Holmes, whatever gives you the idea that the man believed?" "It's obvious, Watson," Holmes said. "CIB, as I have told you at least 1,000 times. Character indexes behaviour. It amused him to keep them in bondage by means of his will." He looked an aside at Lestrade. "No trust arrangements, I take it?
No entailments of any sort?
Lestrade shook his head.
None whatever. Extraordinary, I said. Not at all, Watson. Character indexes behaviour, remember. He wanted them to soldier along in the belief that all would be theirs when he did them the courtesy of dying. But he never actually intended any such thing. Such behaviour would, in fact, have run completely across the grain of his character. Do you agree, Lestrade?
As a matter of fact, I do, Lestrade replied.
Then we are very well to this point, Watson, are we not? All is clear? Lord Hull realizes he is dying. He waits, makes absolutely sure that this time it's no mistake, no false alarm, and then he calls his beloved family together. When? This morning, Lestrade?
Lestrade grunted an affirmative.
Holmes steepled his fingers beneath his chin. He calls them together and tells them he's made a new will, one which disinherits all of them. All that is, save for the servants, his few distant relatives, and, of course, the pussies.
I opened my mouth to speak, only to discover I was too outraged to say anything. The image which kept returning to my mind was that of those cruel boys making the starving East End curs jump with a bit of pork or a crumb of crust from a meat pie. I must add, it never occurred to me to ask whether such a will could be disputed before the bar. Today, a man would have a deuce of a time slighting his closest relatives in favour of a cat hotel. But in 1899, a man's will was a man's will. And unless many examples of insanity, not eccentricity, but outright insanity, could be proved, a man's will, like God's, was done.
This new will was properly witnessed, Holmes asked.
Indeed it was, Lestrade replied. Yesterday, Lord Hull's solicitor and one of his assistants appeared at the house and were shown into Hull's study. There they remained for about 15 minutes. Stephen Hull says the solicitor once raised his voice in protest about something, he could not tell what, and was silenced by Hull. Jory, the middle son, was upstairs painting, and Lady Hull was calling on a friend. But both Stephen and William Hull saw these legal fellows enter and leave a short time later. William said that they left with their heads down, and although William spoke, asking Mr. Barnes, the solicitor, if he was well, and making some social remark about the persistence of the rain, Barnes did not reply, and the assistant seemed actually to cringe. It was as if they were ashamed, William said.
Well, so much for that possible loophole, I thought.
Since we are on the subject, tell me about the boys, Holmes invited.
As you like. It goes pretty much without saying that their hatred for the pater was exceeded only by the pater's boundless contempt for them, although how he could hold Stephen in contempt is... Well, never mind, I'll keep things in their proper order.
Yes, please be so kind as to do that, Holmes said dryly.
William is 36. If his father had given him any sort of allowance, I suppose he would be a bounder. As he had little or none, he has spent his days in various gymnasiums, involved in what I believe is called physical culture. He appears to be an extremely muscular fellow, and his nights in various cheap coffee houses for the most part. If he did happen to have a bit of money in his pockets, he was apt to take himself off to a card parlour, where he would lose it quickly enough. Not a pleasant man, Holmes. A man who has no purpose, no skill, no hobby, and no ambition, save to outlive his father, could hardly be a pleasant man. I had the queerest idea while talking to him that I was interrogating not a man, but an empty vase upon which the face of Lord Hull had been lightly stamped.
A vase waiting to be filled up with pounds sterling, Holmes commented.
Jewelry is another matter, Lestrade went on. Lord Hull saved most of his contempt for him, calling him from his earliest childhood by such endearing pet names as Fish Face and Keg Legs and Stoat Belly. It's not hard to understand such names, unfortunately. Jury Hull stands no more than 5 feet tall, if that, is bow-legged and of a remarkably ugly countenance. He looks a bit like that poet fellow, the Puff. Oscar Wilde? Asked I.
Holmes turned a brief, amused glance upon me. I think Lestrade means Algernon Swinburne, he said, who, I believe, is no more a puff than you are, Watson.
Jory Hull was born dead, Lestrade said. After he remained blue and still for an entire minute, the doctor pronounced him so and put a napkin over his misshapen body. Lady Hull, in her one moment of heroism, sat up, removed the napkin, and dipped the baby's legs into the hot water which had been brought to be used at the birth. The baby began to squirm and squall. Lestrade grinned and lit a cigarillo with a flourish. Hull claimed this immersion had caused the boy's bowed legs, and when he was in his cups, he taxed his wife with it. Told her she should have left well enough alone. Better Jory had been born dead than live to be what he was, he sometimes said. A scuttling creature with the legs of a crab and the face of a cod. Holmes's only reaction to this extraordinary, and to my physician's mind rather suspect, story was to comment that Lestrade had gotten a remarkably large body of information in a remarkably short period of time. That points up one of the aspects of the case which I thought would appeal to you, my dear Holmes, Lestrade said, as we swept into Rotten Row with a splash and a swirl. They need no coercion to speak. Coercion's what it would take to shut 'em up. They've had to remain silent all too long, and then there's the fact that the new will is gone. Relief loosens tongues beyond measure, I find.
Gone! I exclaimed.
But Holmes took no notice. His mind still ran upon Jory, the misshapen middle child.
Is he ugly, then?
He asked Lestrade.
Hardly handsome, but not as bad as some I've seen,
Lestrade replied comfortably. I believe his father continually heaped vituperation on his head because
he was the only one who had no need of his father's money to make his way in the world,
Holmes finished for him.
Lestrade started.
The devil! How did you know that?
Because Lord Hull was reduced to carping at Jory's physical faults. How it must have chafed the old devil to be faced with a potential target so well armoured in other respects. Baiting a man for his looks or his posture may be fine for schoolboys or drunken louts, but a villain like Lord Hull had no doubt become used to higher sport. I would venture the opinion that he may have been rather afraid of his bow-legged middle son. What was Jory's key to the cell door?
Haven't I told you?
He paints, Lestrade said.
Ah!
Jory Hull was, as the canvases in the lower halls of Hull House later proved, a very good painter indeed.
Not great. I do not mean that at all.
But his renderings of his mother and brothers were faithful enough so that, years later, when I saw colour photographs for the first time, my mind flashed back to that rainy November afternoon in 1899. And the one of his father perhaps was a work of greatness. Certainly it startled, almost intimidated, with the malevolence that seemed to waft out of the canvas like a breath of dank graveyard air. Perhaps it was Algernon Swinburne that Jory resembled, but his father's likeness, at least as seen through the middle son's hand and eye, reminded me of an Oscar Wilde character, that nearly immortal roué, Dorian Gray. His canvases were long, slow processes, but he was able to quick sketch with such nimble rapidity that he might come home from Hyde Park on a Saturday afternoon with as much as £20 in his pockets.
I'll wager his father enjoyed that, Holmes said.
He reached automatically for his pipe, then put it back again.
The son of a peer, quick-sketching wealthy American tourists and their sweethearts like a French bohemian.
Lestrade laughed heartily.
He raged over it, as you may imagine. But Jory, good for him, wouldn't give over his selling stall in Hyde Park, not at least until his father agreed to an allowance of £35 a week. He called it low blackmail.
My heart bleeds, I said.
As does mine, Watson, Holmes said. The third son, Lestrade, quickly. We've almost reached the house, I believe.
As Lestrade had intimated, surely Stephen Hull had the greatest cause to hate his father. As his gout grew worse and his head more muddled, Lord Hull surrendered more and more of the company affairs to Stephen, who was only 28 at the time of his father's death. The responsibilities devolved upon Stephen, and the blame also devolved upon him if his least decision proved amiss. Yet no financial gain accrued to him should he decide well and his father's affairs prosper. Lord Hull should have looked with favour upon Stephen, as the only one of his children with an interest in and an aptitude for the business he had founded. Stephen was a perfect example of what the Bible calls the good son. Yet instead of displaying love and gratitude, Lord Hull repaid the young man's largely successful efforts with scorn, suspicion, and jealousy. On many occasions during the last 2 years of his life, the old man had offered the charming opinion that Stephen would steal the pennies from a dead man's eyes. "The bastard!" I cried, unable to contain myself. "Ignore the new will for a moment," Holmes said, steepling his fingers again, "and return to the old one." Even under the conditions of that marginally more generous document, Stephen Hull would have had cause for resentment. In spite of all his labours, which had not only saved the family fortune but increased it, his reward was still to have been the youngest son's share of the spoils. What, by the way, was to have been the disposition of the shipping company under the provisions of what we might call the Pussy Will? I looked carefully at Holmes, but as always, it was difficult to tell if he had attempted a small bon mot. Even after all the years I spent with him and all the adventures we shared, Sherlock Holmes's sense of humour remains a largely undiscovered country, even to me. It was to be handed over to the board of directors with no provision for Stephen, Lestrade said, and pitched his cigarillo out the window as the hackney swept up the curving drive of a house which looked extraordinarily ugly to me just then, as it stood amid its brown lawns in the driving rain. Yet with the father dead and the new will nowhere to be found, Stephen Hull has what the Americans call leverage. The company will have him as managing director. They should have done anyway, but now it will be on Stephen Hull's terms. "Yes," Holmes said. "Leverage. A good word." He leaned out into the rain. "Stop short, driver," he cried. "We've not quite done."
"As you say, governor,"
the driver returned, "but it's devilish wet out here." "And you'll go with enough in your pocket to make your innards as wet and devilish as your outards," Holmes said. This seemed to satisfy the man, and he stopped 30 yards from the front door of the great house. I listened to the rain, tapping on the sides of the coach, while Holmes cogitated and then said, "The old will, the one he teased them with. That document isn't missing, is it?" "Absolutely not. It was on his desk, near his body." "Four excellent suspects. Servants need not apply. Or so it seems now. Finish quickly, Lestrade, the final circumstances and the locked room." Lestrade complied quickly, consulting his notes from time to time. A month previous, Lord Hull had observed a small black spot on his right leg, directly behind the knee. The family doctor was called. His diagnosis was gangrene, an unusual but far from rare result of gout and poor circulation. The doctor told him the leg would have to come off and well above the site of the infection. Lord Hull laughed until tears streamed down his cheeks. The doctor, who had expected any reaction but this, was struck speechless. "When they stick me in my coffin, sawbones," Hull said, "it will be with both legs still attached, thank you very much." The doctor told him that he sympathised with Lord Hull's wish to keep his leg, but that without amputation he would be dead in 6 months, and he would spend the last 2 in exquisite pain. Lord Hull asked the doctor what his chances of survival should be if he were to undergo the operation. He was still laughing, Lestrade said, as though it were the best joke he had ever heard. After some hemming and hawing, the doctor said the odds were even. "Bunk," said I. "Exactly what Lord Hull said," Lestrade replied, "except he used a term more often used in dosses than in drawing rooms." Hull told the doctor that he himself reckoned his chances at no better than 1 in 5.
As to the pain, I don't think it will come to that, he went on, as long as there's laudanum and a spoon to stir it with in stumping distance.
The next day, Hull finally sprang his nasty surprise that he was thinking of changing his will. Just how, he did not immediately say.
Oh, Holmes said, looking at Lestrade from those cool grey eyes that saw so much. And who, pray, was surprised?
None of them, I should think. But you know human nature, Holmes, how people hope against hope.
And how some plan against disaster, Holmes said dreamily.
This very morning, Lord Hull had called his family into the parlour, and when all was settled, he performed an act few testators are granted, one which is usually performed by the wagging tongues of their solicitors after their own have been forever silenced. In short, he read them his new will, leaving the balance of his estate to Mrs. Hemphill's wayward pussies. In the silence which followed, he rose, not without difficulty, and favoured them all with a death's head grin. And leaning over his cane, he made the following declaration, which I find as astoundingly vile now as I did when Lestrade recounted it to us in that hackney cab.
So, all is fine, is it not? Yes, very fine. You have served me quite faithfully, woman and boys, for some 40 years. Now I intend, with the clearest and most serene conscience imaginable, to cast you hence. But take heart. Things could be worse. If there was time, the pharaohs had their favourite pets, cats for the most part, killed before they died, so the pets might be there to welcome them into the afterlife, to be kicked or petted there at their master's whims forever. And forever. And forever.
And he laughed at them. He leaned over his cane and laughed from his doughy, dying face. The new will, properly signed and properly witnessed, as all of them had seen, clutched in one claw of a hand. William rose and said,
Sir, you may be my father and the author of my existence, but you are also the lowest creature to crawl upon the face of the earth since the serpent tempted Eve in the garden.
Not at all, the old monster returned, still laughing. I know four lower. Now, if you will pardon me, I have some important papers to put away in my safe and some worthless ones to burn in the stove.
He still had the old will when he confronted them? Holmes asked. He seemed more interested than startled.
Yes.
He could have burnt it as soon as the new one was signed and witnessed, Holmes mused. He had all the previous afternoon and evening to do so, but he didn't, did he? Why not? How say you on that question, Lestrade?
He hadn't had enough of teasing them even then, I suppose.
He was offering them a chance. A temptation he believed all would refuse.
Perhaps he believed one of them would not refuse, Holmes said. Hasn't that idea at least crossed your mind?
He turned his head and searched my face with a momentary beam of his brilliant and somehow chilling regard.
Either of your minds? Isn't it possible that such a black creature might hold out such a temptation, knowing that if one of his family were to succumb to it and put him out of his misery, Stephen seems most likely from what you say, that one might be caught and swing for the crime of patricide?
I stared at Holmes in silent horror.
Never mind, Holmes said. Go on, Inspector. It's time for the locked room to make its appearance, I believe.
The four of them had sat in paralysed silence, as the old man made his long, slow way up the corridor to his study. There were no sounds but the thud of his cane, the laboured rattle of his breathing, the plaintive meow of a cat in the kitchen, and the steady beat of the pendulum in the parlour clock. Then they heard the squeal of hinges as Hull opened his study door and stepped inside.
Wait!
Holmes said sharply, sitting forward.
No one actually saw him go in, did they?
I'm afraid that's not so, old chap, Lestrade returned. Mr. Oliver Stanley, Lord Hull's valet, had heard Lord Hull's progress down the hall. He came from Hull's dressing chamber, went to the gallery railing, and called down to ask if all was well. Hull looked up. Stanley saw him as plainly as I see you right now, old fellow, and said all was absolutely tip-top. Then he rubbed the back of his head, went in, and locked the study door behind him.
By the time his father had reached the door, the corridor is quite long, and it may have taken him as much as 2 minutes to make his way up it unaided, Stephen had shaken off his stupor and had gone to the parlour door. He saw the exchange between his father and his father's man. Of course, Lord Hull was back too, but Stephen heard his father's voice and described the same characteristic gesture, Hull rubbing the back of his head. Could Stephen Hull and this Stanley fellow have spoken before the police arrived? I asked. Shrewdly, I thought. Well, of course they could, Lestrade said wearily. They probably did, but there was no collusion.
You feel sure of that? Holmes asked, but he sounded uninterested.
Yes, Stephen Hull would lie very well, I think, but Stanley would do it very badly. Accept my professional opinion or not, just as you like, Holmes.
I accept it.
So Lord Hull passed into his study, the famous locked room, and all heard the click of the lock as he turned the key, the only key there was to that sanctum sanctorum. This was followed by a more unusual sound, the bolt being drawn across. Then, silence. The four of them, Lady Hull and her sons, so shortly to be blue-blooded paupers, looked at one another in similar silence. The cat meowed again from the kitchen, and Lady Hull said in a distracted voice that if the housekeeper wouldn't give that cat a bowl of milk, she supposed she must. She said the sound of it would drive her mad if she had to listen to it much longer. She left the parlour. Moments later, without a word among them, the three sons also left. William went to his room upstairs. Stephen wandered into the music room, and Jory went to sit upon a bench beneath the stairs where, he had told Lestrade, he had gone since earliest childhood when he was sad or had matters of deep difficulty to think over. Less than 5 minutes later, a shriek arose from the study. Stephen ran out of the music room, where he'd been plinking out isolated notes on the piano. Jory met him at the study door. William was already halfway downstairs and saw them breaking in when Stanley, the valet, came out of Lord Hull's dressing room and went to the gallery railing for the second time. Stanley has testified to seeing Stephen Hull burst into the study, to seeing William reach the foot of the stairs and almost fall on the marble, to seeing Lady Hull come from the dining room doorway with a pitcher of milk still in one hand. Moments later, the rest of the servants had gathered. Lord Hull was slumped over his writing desk with the three brothers standing by. His eyes were open, and the look in them, I believe it was surprise. Again, you are free to accept or reject my opinion just as you like, but I tell you it looked very much like surprise to me. Clutched in his hands was his will, the old one. Of the new one there was no sign, and there was a dagger in his back. With this, Lestrade rapped for the driver to go on. We entered the house between two constables as stone-faced as Buckingham Palace sentinels. Here to begin with was a very long hall, floored in black and white marble tiles like a chessboard. They led to an open door at the end, where two more constables were posted, the entrance to the infamous study. To the left were the stairs, to the right two doors, the parlour and the music room, I guessed. The family is gathered in the parlour, Lestrade said.
Good, Holmes said pleasantly. But perhaps Watson and I might first have a look at the scene of the crime.
Shall I accompany you?
Perhaps not, Holmes said.
Has the body been removed?
It was still here when I left for your lodgings, but by now it almost certainly will be gone.
Very good.
Holmes started away. I followed,
Lestrade called, "Holmes!" Holmes turned, eyebrows raised. "No secret panels, no secret doors. For the third time, take my word or not, as you like. I believe I'll wait until..." Holmes began, and then his breath began to hitch. He scrambled in his pocket, found a napkin probably carried absently away from the eating house where we had dined the previous evening, and sneezed mightily into it. I looked down and saw a large, scarred tomcat, as out of place here in this grand hall as would have been one of those urchins of whom I had been thinking earlier, twining about Holmes's legs. One of its ears was laid back against its scarred skull. The other was gone, lost in some long-ago alley battle, I supposed. Holmes sneezed repeatedly and kicked out at the cat. It went with a reproachful backward look, rather than with the angry hiss one might have expected from such an old campaigner. Holmes looked at Lestrade over the napkin with reproachful, watery eyes. Lestrade, not in the least put out of countenance, thrust his head forward and grinned like a monkey. 10, Holmes, he said. 10. Houses full of felines. How loved 'em. And with that, he walked off. How long have you suffered this affliction, old fellow? I asked. I was a bit alarmed. Always, he said, and sneezed again. The word allergy was hardly known all those years ago, but that, of course, was his problem. Do you want to leave? I asked. I had once seen a case of near asphyxiation as a result of such an aversion, this one to sheep, but otherwise similar in all respects. He'd like that, Holmes said. I did not need him to tell me whom he meant. Holmes sneezed once more. A large red welt was appearing on his normally pale forehead, and then we passed between the constables at the study door. Holmes closed it behind him.